of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. First today, what Machiavelli and St. Francis can tell us about today's CEOs. And this is part of a regular column in the Religion News Service called The Conversation. Niccolò Machiavelli, the infamous author of The Prince, wrote in the 1500s that the ideal leader makes and breaks solemn agreements. He creates alliances with weak allies to defeat a powerful enemy and then eliminates them one by one. He blames his next in charge for his own mistakes and executes opponents in public. St. Francis of Assisi was the antithesis of a Machiavellian leader. Born in 1181, the future saint renounced his father's wealth, then spent the remainder of his life wandering around northern Italy as a beggar and preacher. Francis gained a reputation for extreme humility, but certainly he was not weak. He dealt with popes, nobles, and even an Egyptian sultan. He founded a religious order, the Franciscans, that survives today. In modern times, Machiavellian leaders abound in the corporate world. Perhaps more surprisingly, many other business leaders resemble Francis. Humble and self-effacing, but by no means weak. In our research, we argue that two types of motivation can help explain these vast and enduring differences in leadership. Psychologists have long been fascinated by people's unconscious motives and how to measure them. One influential assessment developed in the 1930s is the thematic apperception test, or TAT. People write short stories about ambiguous pictures, and researchers then analyze the stories to see which themes emerge, what the writer cares or worries about, and how they see the world. In 1970, psychologist David McClelland coined the phrase, quote, two faces, the two faces of power, end quote, to describe two different types of power that motivate people, based on his TAT analyses. Personal power and socialized power. Personal power is the motivation to dominate others. McClelland noted that people with a desire for personal power tend to use imagery that evokes the law of the jungle in which the strongest survive by destroying their adversaries. Socialized power, on the other hand, aims to benefit others. McClelland noted that personal power was associated with behavior, like heavy drinking, gambling, aggressive impulses, and collecting prestige supplies, like convertibles. People concerned with the more socialized aspect of power, meanwhile, join more organizations and are more apt to become officers in them, including sports teams. A few years later, McClelland and consultant David Burnham published an article titled, Power is the Great Motivator, elaborating on this basic link between power motivation and leader effectiveness. Through a series of biographical vignettes and an analysis of a large company, they showed that managers exhibiting a high degree of socialized power were more effective than managers motivated by personal power. It seemed to us that personal power, or the law of the jungle, motivates the kinds of behavior approvingly described by Machiavelli. Likewise, socialized power seems to underlie the forceful but altruistic behavior of St. Francis and modern so-called humble leaders. But we faced a problem: how to measure motivation. Powerful people such as world-class CEOs have little inclination to take TAT tests or answer questionnaires for admittedly humble scholars. In the 1990s, psychologist David Winter showed that speeches, interviews, and diplomatic tests reveal texts, reveal unconscious motivation in the same way as the thematic apperception test, demonstrating a way to study leaders' views of power. For example, someone driven by a desire for personal power often tries to control or regulate people around them, attempts to persuade and convince, and is concerned with fame, status, and reputation. However, Winter's procedures for analyzing texts are manual and complex. It is difficult to process a large number of documents. Also, he focused on personal power. Socialized power was not included in his coding procedures. In order to overcome these limitations, we used computer-aided text analysis to analyze the language of CEOs in interviews and conference calls. In a series of 2019 studies, which were peer-reviewed and summarized in the Academy of Management Proceedings, our team identified 40 Machiavellian and 40 humble CEOs. First, we took a close look at the types of words and phrases that distinguish the two groups, shedding light on the kind of power that motivates each one. Using these patterns, we created two dictionaries of words and phrases that express personal power and socialized power. Language about strong, forceful actions, control, managing impressions, punishment, and fear of failure, to name a few themes, constituted the personal power dictionary. Defeat, overrun, and strafe, for example, appeared among the words on the personal power list. Themes such as rewards, mentoring, and positive relationships characterized the socialized power dictionary. Then we used a computer program to scan hundreds of interviews and quarterly conference calls. The computer program calculated personal and socialized power scores for each of the CEOs. Our team also developed indexes of Machiavellian and humble leader behavior, such as smearing competitors and backing out of agreements, or making significant donations to charity, respectively, and measured all 80 CEOs. We found very high correlations between power motivation and CEO behavior. CEOs with high personal power scores, based on our analysis of their interviews and conference calls, also tended to show Machiavellian behavior. CEO humble behavior was positively related to socialized power. Do these abstract statistical results really mean anything? Evidently. Numerous CEOs from our list of humble executives have founded or managed exceptionally successful and people-oriented companies, including Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, Danny Wegman of Wegmans, and James Goodnight of the SAS Institute. Several of the humble CEOs have appeared multiple times on Fortune's annual Best Companies to Work For list. The Machiavellian CEO list included Kenneth Lay of Enron fame and John Regis, one of the founders of Adelphia Communications Corporation, who was convicted of fraud. Mark Hurd, one-time CEO of Hewlett-Packard, appeared on Complex's list of the worst chief executive officers in tech history. In general, criticisms over profits over people, poor treatment of employees, scandals, lavish spending, lawsuits and accusations, or convictions of fraud characterize many of our Machiavellian CEOs. McClellan and Burnham were right. Power really is a great motivator, but it's the type of power that makes the difference. Our second story, the last pastor in blockaded Sudan city holds out for remaining Christians. This was written by Frederick and Zwilly, and this is from Nairobi, Kenya. In the besieged Sudanese city of El Fasser, the Reverend Darmali Abudigan is staying on, even as random bombs, stray bullets, and hunger kill members of his flock. The 44-year-old priest has kept St. Matthew of the Anglican Church of Sudan open to all Christians after increased fighting has forced other pastors and priests to flee. Here people live one day at a time, and if stray bombs and bullets do not kill them, hunger does not spare them, especially children. In May, the priest lost five church members who were living with him after the armed men randomly shot at the church compound. The deaths nearly moved him to abandon the city. I didn't leave the church. In a while, I considered leaving, but I changed my mind. I am still staying with my flock. Wherever we lose a person, it makes me very sad, said Abudingen, who lives in the city with his wife and three sons. El-Fasser, the capital of North Darfur, one of five states in the Darfur region, has been under a blockade from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces since April of last year. The group declared a blockade after local militia declared allegiance to the Sudan Armed Forces. The fighting in Sudan began in April of 2023, 4 years after the two groups that worked together to overthrow the dictator, Hassan Omar al-Bashir, disagreed on the direction the country should take. The two forces, both largely consisting of Muslims, have battled for control of the country since then. Beginning in March, the battle shifted to Darfur, the RSF's base in the west of the country, after the army pushed the paramilitary out of the capital, Khartoum, and other areas. Recently, the RSF has intensified attacks on the city to capture it from the army. The force has carried out ground and aerial assaults, launching missile attacks, and has constantly shelled the city. Its battle wagons have also attempted to storm the city. At least 57 people died in the city on August 11th after the militias opened fire on homes and streets. The bombs and the bullets strike homes, Abudingen told Religion News Service in an online interview. The markets are very dangerous. One can lose their life anywhere and any time. The Reverend Luca Jomo, pastor of a Catholic church in El-Fasser, was struck by a stray bullet when paramilitary militias attacked the city in June. Abudingen, who knew Jomo well, rushed him to the hospital, but it was too late to save his life. The two young men staying with him were also killed. Catholic Church sources said they tried to help Jomo leave, but the RSF militia encircling it, with RSF militia, encircling it, he remained trapped. Abudingen has welcomed any Christian who wants to worship in the city. There are no other pastors in Darfur in general. I am the only one in El-Fasser, and I usually combine worshippers in one church to save them from random bombings and shootings, said Abudingen. Abudingen, who was ordained in 2010, grew up in the Nuba Mountains, a region bordering South Sudan that is protected by another militia, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, and has become home to 700,000 refugees. El-Fasser has its own displaced persons camp, Abu Shouk and Zamzam. Of the 57 killed on August 11th, at least 40 were residents of Abu Shouk. In April, the RSF struck both camps, killing more than 100 people, including 20 children and 10 aid workers. Apart from stray bullets and bombs, Abudingen said many die from hunger, as people cannot afford what little food there is in the city. Many children have malnutrition, and we are going to see many of them dying if they do not get help urgently. There is food in the market, but the people cannot afford it because they do not have any money now. Again, the food is too expensive, said the priest. The church, he said, is not able to help the people because it is also struggling with resources. As a pastor, I am struggling to cope because what the church sends for upkeep is not enough. They used to send me 20,000 Sudanese pounds, or about U.S. dollar 330, per month, but now this cannot feed me for 2 days. The United Nations last year declared famine conditions in Zamzam, a camp of displaced persons in the city, but workers for its World Food Program have not been able to get to the city to offer assistance. The militias have also blocked trade and food supply channels, forcing an escalation of food prices. Abudigan called on the international community and the global Christian community to act quickly to save Sudan from the war, especially El Fasser. Food is urgently needed because hunger is killing people every day. As I am talking to you about hunger, we have lost a child because of it, and another two because of disease, since there are no medicines, he said. Next, supporting religious diversity on campus is a surprising consensus among faculty across the red-blue divide. This is written by Matthew J. Mayhew, professor of higher education at The Ohio State University. Universities, often perceived as bastions of progressive thought, are increasingly reflecting the broader political polarization gripping the nation. Faculty members represent a university's core identity and mission. They express the values of the institution in numerous ways, including teaching, mentoring, advising, and researching. In my research into the impact of college on student development and learning, I and others have found that faculty are the most important people influencing student learning, development, persistence, and degree attainment. However, no systematic efforts have ever been undertaken to find out how faculty's work is influenced by their understanding of university life and religion. Until now, the Templeton Religion Trust, a charity focusing on improving societal well-being through understanding individual well-being, funded a recent national survey my team and I administered to 1,000 faculty members. The survey asked faculty about their perceptions of university life, including free speech and diversity, equity and inclusion initiatives, often shortened to simply DEI. The survey results reveal a striking divergence in perspectives on the often divisive issues of free speech and DEI among faculty. Those differences showed up particularly along the red state and blue state divide. Yet, amid those deep disagreements, a surprising point of bipartisan consensus emerges. Faculty members' belief in the importance of religious, spiritual, and secular inclusion in diversity efforts. Survey responses represented national trends across various factors, including region, institutional control, institutional type, and academic discipline. In part of the analysis, we uncovered that a political leanings of a state, how a state voted in the presidential election of 2024, play a significant role in what faculty perceive about free speech and DEI programming. Even more compelling, significant differences reported by faculty from red versus blue states showed up consistently across gender, race, religion, academic discipline, faculty rank, and whether the faculty member was employed at a private or public institution. In other words, political leanings of a state were strongly associated with faculty perceptions, regardless of these other factors. We asked faculty 4 questions related to their First Amendment rights, which we presented as: the First Amendment protects freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom to petition. Working closely with experts in legal epidemiology, we asked faculty the extent to which they agreed with the following statements. A. The First Amendment is relevant to my job as a faculty member. B. The First Amendment is relevant to my research engagement. C. My institution provides me with my constitutionally mandated First Amendment rights. And D. I am aware of my rights and responsibilities as they relate to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. While awareness of First Amendment rights appears consistent across the board, a notable difference arises in faculty members' perception of institutional protection of those rights. Faculty in blue states are significantly more likely than those in red states to report that their institutions uphold their constitutionally mandated First Amendment rights. This implies a potential disconnect in how freedoms are experienced and protected, depending on the political leanings of the state where an institution is located. The divide deepens when it comes to DEI, defined in the survey as campus diversity programs in some instances, and diversity, equity, and inclusion in others. When compared with faculty in blue states, those in red states are far more inclined to view DEI efforts as overreach, agreeing with the statements that diversity programs generally do more harm than good on college and university campuses, and the promotion of diversity, equity, and inclusion on college and university campuses has gone too far. Conversely, blue state faculty largely agree with these assertions. When compared with faculty in red states, those in blue states were more likely to agree that campus diversity programs support student success, demonstrating a stark ideological chasm on the value and impact of DEI. This partisan disagreement extends to the very concept of banning DEI programs. Red state faculty show moderate support for banning DEI, suggesting a belief that current efforts to curtail campus diversity initiatives are, according to their survey response options, well justified. Blue state faculty overwhelmingly support the continuation of these programs. They gave strong endorsement to the idea that colleges and universities should continue to offer identity-specific organizations and programming. The schism reflects the ongoing national debate about the role and scope of DEI in higher education. Faculty perspectives mirror the political sentiments of their respective regions. Amid this significant polarization, a crucial area of common ground emerges: what we call religious, spiritual, and secular inclusion. That's the idea that DEI efforts should include programming and activities designed to help students from all religious, spiritual, and secular backgrounds belong and succeed. Despite their sharp disagreements on other aspects of DEI, both red state and blue state faculty overwhelmingly agree that colleges and universities should provide support for students of all religious, secular, and spiritual identities and backgrounds. And both groups similarly reject the notion that campuses should not concern themselves with religious, secular, and spiritual diversity. The findings from the survey highlight the complex landscape of faculty opinion in higher education. While significant differences remain in reconciling differing views on free speech and DEI, the shared commitment to religious, spiritual, and secular inclusion offers a potential path to agreement. By focusing on areas of consensus, institutions can begin to foster more inclusive environments to serve the needs of all students, regardless of their background or beliefs. Understanding these nuanced perspectives is the first step toward building more cohesive, pluralistic, and intellectually vibrant academic communities across the nation's varied political terrain. Our next news story. Pope demands end to the, quote, pandemic of arms, end quote, as he prays for victims of Minnesota school shooting. Pope Leo XIV on Sunday called for an end to the pandemic of arms, large and small, as he prayed publicly for the victims of a shooting during a Catholic school mass in the United States. History's first U.S. Pope spoke in English as he denounced the attack and the logic of weapons fueling wars around the world during his Sunday noon blessing from his studio overlooking St. Peter's Square. Our prayers for the victims of the tragic shooting during a school mass in the American state of Minnesota, said the Chicago-born Leo. We hold in our prayers the countless children killed and injured every day around the world. Let us plead God to stop the pandemic of arms, large and small, which infects our world. Two children were killed Wednesday, and 20 people were injured during the shooting attack at the Church of Annunciation in Minneapolis, as hundreds of students from the nearby Annunciation Catholic School and others gathered for a mass. The shooter fired 116 rifle rounds through the church's stained glass windows and later died by suicide. The attack once again reignited the debate over guns in America. Those who support stricter background checks on gun purchases and other laws, often Democrats, say that Republican politicians who appeal to thoughts and prayers after school shootings are trying to distract from their own inaction on gun restrictions. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, Leo had refrained from any political commentary about guns in America, sending a telegram of condolence that focused exclusively on the spiritual. He said he was saddened by the terrible tragedy and sent his heartfelt condolences and the assurance of spiritual closeness to all those affected. Leo's predecessor, Pope Francis, had long railed against the weapons industry and proliferation of arms, fueling wars, denouncing gun manufacturers as merchants of death. During his historic 2015 speech to the U.S. Congress, the Argentine Pope asked the lawmakers why weapons were being sold purely to kill. Pope Leo had opened his appeal Sunday by demanding an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine and a serious commitment to dialogue from the warring sides. It's time that those responsible renounce the logic of weapons and take the path of negotiations and peace. With the support of the international community, he said, the voice of weapons must be silenced, while the voice of fraternity and justice must rise. This last story was provided by the Associated Press Religion Coverage, which receives support through the Associated Press and funding from the Lilly Endowment. The AP is solely responsible for this content. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.